Self-driving robot fooled by Facebook. The geeks are back with stories from self-driving cars to Facebook, Facebook, and Facebook.
Recording from Scotts Valley, California, in Miles' home, I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is Geek Speak. Miles, thanks for joining me in your house. How are you? Have you been? It's been a month.
It's actually my mother's house. There's a little bit more room there, and there's no screaming child.
That is true. There's a dog, but so far he's very quiet. Miles, it's been a long time since you and I did a show.
Yeah.
I think early February is when we last did it, so we've...
Really? February?
What's remarkable is that I decided to stop being on the radio, which took a lot of time to edit the show down to an exact hour and make sure it was appropriate for
audience. We hadn't done it since...
So I stopped doing the radio, and that, of course, has given me a lot of freedom, which I have taken advantage of to much joy.
Well, you called off the radio spot because you were getting too stressed out with work, and so obviously you're too stressed out with work, too stressed out with actually doing the recording for a while. So.
Yeah.
Hopefully things have gotten better since then.
Yeah, a few things have happened, actually. So I stopped doing the radio show. I have done a show since then. I also have another podcast. I've been cheating on you all. And I feel a little guilty. Have you listened to the new podcast that I did?
I haven't.
You'd probably dig it.
Dude, did I tell you about the last couple of weeks?
I know, you've been very busy. Miles launched a product that fell on its face, and you spent like 4 days fixing it.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But we won't get into detail because you work for a business that has
right.
a business. The podcast that I've launched is called We Are Netflix. And it's basically staff of Netflix talking about what they do at work. The first episode is with two software engineers that work on the iOS platform. And it's just a discussion about like kind of working there. And if you listen to Geek Speak regularly, you probably won't be any surprised, but it feels very much like a Geek Speak episode, really loose in the way we discuss. But man, the numbers are fast and grow quickly when you deal with a podcast that Netflix produces, that Netflix promotes. Man, so last WWDC, the WWDC is Apple's yearly conference. It's coming up in June, I think. And last year's, they had a podcasting, some new podcasting stuff that came out. One of the things they decided to do was that if you use the podcasting app that Apple makes, which is not a good podcasting app at all, but it's on the iOS devices. You can download it, and there's also built into iTunes. If you use those and you have the most recent version of Mac or iOS software, and you say you want to share data with developers, the play history that you experience, like you're watching listening to the audio and stuff, that play history actually gets sent to Apple, and they anonymize it, and then they give you stats as a podcast owner. You get to see the stats, which is okay. It's a very small percentage of our audience base, actually, use it. But it's neat because every hour it feels like it's updated. But you can also see how much drop-off there is on the podcast playing, which is neat. So you can see that
curve. You can find exactly how boring we are and at what points. Yeah,
I will tell you all about that when I analyze this episode. Anyway, it's been neat seeing, you know, one datum of GeekSpeak itself, which, of course, has smaller numbers now than the podcast I do with Netflix, even though I've been doing the GeekSpeak series with you for 17 years. When you post to online forums with tens of thousands of people following the count, it's amazing how many people join. Anyway, so it's kind of been fun to have that kind of knowledge about how people listen to audio and all that. Maybe I'll do a future episode and a little bit of analysis about that. It's kind of neat. Any case, so I've been busy doing a second podcast. That's part of the problem. Actually, a third, because I do an internal podcast as well. So. And of course, the biggest problem is that I edit all those, and editing takes time, as you probably know. Oh, wait, you wouldn't know that, would you?
Oh, I've edited, just not lately.
In 2005, I think you edited once?
Oh, come on. I've edited a lot more than that.
Yeah, I think that the periods of like a few months when I had children, that's when you started. I took breaks for Geek Speak. Any case, let's get to the news. It's been too long. Tell me about what California is thinking about doing.
Well, this is actually about self-driving cars in general. And we talked about this several years ago, that one of the major issues with it wasn't going to be the ability of cars to drive themselves. It was going to be people's willingness to accept it.
Yeah, sure.
Things have gotten a little complicated from that.
We did have a death last week.
Was it last week? It
2 weeks ago.
Yeah. So specifically, California had told Uber, yeah, you're not giving us enough data. This is not ready for prime time. You are not allowed to have self-driving cars on California streets. Arizona went, hey, come here. We don't have those crazy regulations that California has. And then someone died. And I don't mean to be
fair.
I don't mean to be glib about that. No. But at the same time, there was, it's come out, a very striking difference between the level of quality control for example, Google's endeavor Waymo, or Alphabet's Waymo, and Uber. In other words,
Waymo is the self-driving car division of Google
or Alphabet. Yeah.
Yeah, there is definitely better quality engineering at Google. Uber. I'm not impressed with Uber as a company in general, but also this accident probably would have occurred if a human had been driving as well.
I'm not so sure of that.
Oh, really?
The initial reports were about how it was the secluded section and someone jumped out, like basically where you couldn't see them at all. And later reports were showing the intersection as it actually appears, and it's not that wide open. Mm. With regard to human eye, yeah, sure, dim light.
Humans can make accidents all the time.
Yeah. Right. But when you have something like LIDAR, that is not so susceptible to our visible spectrum.
Which is what, are the Uber vehicles using LIDAR? Because I know the Google vehicles are.
Yeah, I believe they are.
Okay.
It was a lot. It should have seen it.
Yeah.
Seen the person crossing.
The other thing that you hear about this story is people say, well, you know, one electric vehicle fatality, or one, I'm sorry, autopilot vehicle fatality versus, you know, 3,000 fatalities of people in the same day caused by humans, whatever it is,
right,
the ratio is. But people have to understand there's a lot less self-driving cars on the road. You should have almost no accidents. And of course, we have had almost no accidents of that sort.
Well, that's the thing, though, is the data reports that I've been reading were talking – you speak in terms of autonomous cars at this point when they have a driver, as how often does that driver feel the need to put their hands on the wheel, put their foot on the pedal to try to counteract what the – car is doing.
Stop reading Reddit, you mean?
And the Waymo vehicles, for example, they're going hundreds or even 1,000 miles without any interaction from a human being. They had their stats for how many miles they drove before that. And Uber's was something on the order of like 14 miles.
Yes, yeah, so just not.
It was a whole. Yeah, so it very much felt like the Uber was, what can we do to get to the point where we can get on the road, as opposed to the Waymo looked very much like, what are all the possible scenarios to cover, you know, as a checklist, not as a, what can we think of that can get us onto the road, as a, what can we think of that would prevent us from having an accident?
Right, you know? Right. Tesla also has self-driving cars, or at least lane-changing vehicles.
Yeah, that one's a bit different, and that one... Tesla's been under a lot of scrutiny with regard to how they describe it. There are a lot of folks that say, well, this is like self-driving mode, and Tesla's marketing it in an ambiguous way,
honestly.
But at the same time, telling people, no, the car is constantly binging you, saying you have to put your hands on the wheel. And it will go like, you put your hands on the wheel, ding, ding, put your hands on the wheel. And so when there was a fatality in near Mountain View or Palo Alto, something mm-hmm. like that. There had been indications that it was telling the driver, put your hands on the wheel, and they ignored it. They did hit a lane divider that had already been hit previously, and so the crumple zone had already been crumpled, and that's why it was so much more severe.
I see.
So if it hadn't been crumpled, maybe the driver would have survived. But what they're finding is that there's more evidence that Tesla's autopilot doesn't handle lane dividers very well. There seems to be a pattern emerging.
Interesting.
For Tesla's part, they're saying, well, people should put their hands on the wheel and they shouldn't rely on it so much. But then you go like, well, what's the point in having that in there if it's giving people that sense of
It seems like the
security?
Worst thing to do is kind of tell the human you can relax a bit and don't have to pay attention very much. Like, that's what autopilot does.
Right, right.
And that's just a stupid thing to do to people because, of course, we're not good at having partial attention. That's exactly what you don't want humans to try to do.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that's
Google ever... inattention blindness. It's a really fascinating field of study.
Are you saying to go Google that?
Yeah.
inattention blindness?
Yeah, yeah. Inattention blindness or DuckDuckGo, yeah, whatever you...
Right, like that whole video of the basketball players, right?
There's actually a TV show. It's on Netflix, a quick little plug, called Brain Games, something like that. And it's all about, you know, the way our perception is not reality. and one of the episodes is specifically focused on inattention blindness.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a very interesting thing to watch.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to San Francisco actually issuing a ticket for a self-driving vehicle.
Yes.
What self-driving vehicles are around? I mean, they're not commercially being used, right? They're still being in test mode. I mean, in the States, of course.
Right. This is a company called Cruise. Something that self-driving cars have that most human, you know, directed vehicles do not is a very detailed record of all their surroundings.
A complete log of everything they do.
Right. A few people have, for insurance purposes, the dash cam.
Especially if you're in Russia.
You're right. But the front one, maybe people have two, the front and the back.
Yeah.
You could use those, you know, for evidence, yeah, but most people don't have them.
And even if you have them, you're not going to also have speedometer and braking and all these other aspects that vehicle that has to pilot itself has to produce.
Right. The autonomous vehicles have all of this information at all times and
okay,
you
so
know,
one
360
of these cars was ticketed by an officer, pulled over and given a ticket for a moving violation.
Right. People are very familiar, I'm sure, if you've been driving for any amount of time. The notion of some of these tickets may be subjective.
Mm-hmm.
Were you going too fast? Did the cop actually do the radar gun? Was it a gut? Like, this person was obviously going too fast because you eyeballed it.
Right.
How fast is too fast? Because most of the time they won't pull you over if you're going the speed of traffic. But sometimes they do.
When I lived in LA, I had a vehicle. So it was a Volkswagen Cabriolet. And it was a relatively heavy vehicle, but also the shocks were really firm on it. So when you drove it at any speed, it looked like you were speeding because the vehicle did that kind of hug the road shake effect. And it looked like it was driving fast. I got tickets to that thing all the time.
So the reason I bring this up is because now it's no longer subjective. Like one, when the police officer pulls the car over, and now this is becoming an issue, who pays the ticket? The person who's in the car who isn't really driving.
The software engineer at the last Git commit?
Right, exactly. The company that owns it, the insurance company.
I'm assuming that there was a safety driver in the seat that had to be licensed, and so the ticket was given to them.
Yeah, physically given to them, yes.
Okay, because that was the licensee.
Yeah. Okay. At the same time, the reason I brought up the dash cams and that is that all of this information is logged. And the reason the officer issued the ticket was that they were saying that they were too close to a pedestrian in a crosswalk. It wasn't yielding to the pedestrian in the crosswalk.
That sounds like a problem.
Right, except for the fact that now the car has data and it can tell you exactly how far away the pedestrian was at that moment.
Yeah, but if the person was in the crosswalk and they could have stopped, they should have. I mean, from a legal perspective. So the vehicle might have made an illegal move even if it was safe.
See, there's the question also is, and this I don't know from the information in front of me, but was the person in the crosswalk and had crossed like the median?
Mm-hmm.
So they were still technically in the crosswalk, but that's a scenario that we all turn right because the person is already clear of the area and obviously so and moving in the opposite direction and people just aren't that fast to be able to jump in front of your car.
I wonder if you also like respond to this, even if they win in court because it shows and the judge is like, yeah, that wasn't right. You definitely also want to modify your rules of your self-driving software to not have a situation where a police officer thinks the car is being unsafe. Because even if you're going to win in court, you don't really want to get the ticket. It's a hassle. You'd rather be even more safe than that.
Right.
Or and perceived more safe.
This is also in San Francisco. So very heavily populated, cars and people are very close to one another, usually at slow speeds. And, well, it depends on
there's also times in San Francisco that people are going fast, so it's interesting.
Right, so it's a very interesting thing to be able to say, but the data collected says the pedestrian was exactly 10.8 feet away from the car. It really does change the perspective with regard to traffic police.
Yeah.
And there's also that question now, and this raises the issues that brought up, you know, 3 years ago. Did that officer see the LIDAR dome on the top of the vehicle or whatever, see it, and therefore give it more focus once again, hearkening to inattention blindness, give that focus and therefore put it under more scrutiny than they would have otherwise.
So you got one more news story
right.
about cars.
This goes into legal liability because right now, for all the drivers that are out there, you know, people are fallible, but they're not fallible equally. What tricks one person doesn't trick another. If you held up a stop sign, most people are going to be like, why is that person holding a stop sign, and move on your way? Mm-hmm. The AI behind self-driving cars has two issues with it, which are, one, can it distinguish a stop sign that is being held by a person versus one that is mounted in the ground? Does it recognize the shape of the stop sign and go, oh, that's what I'm supposed to work off of? Or does it work off of knowledge from mapping software about where a stop sign is?
Yeah.
And the other is, if you figure out something that would fool one of the cars, it's going to fool a lot of the cars, at least all of them from the same manufacturer, the same build
right.
on there.
So things like, if you want to make a lane change and there's a self-driving car in the lane you're trying to change into slightly behind you, you could just stick a stop sign out your window and it will stop. And then you go forward. Things like that, right? Where a human being would be like, what are you doing? But a car is just going to respond.
Right. Or self-driving cars where, like, you can put down white lines on the ground around
just it. Just randomly.
Right. And the car won't move because it sees it as an obstacle. The question is...
fun with automata.
Right. What is the legal liability if you do this thing that is marginal to do in the human space, but knowledge that it would break the AI?
I think if you're intentionally doing that, then you're interfering with traffic. It's just like throwing an object into traffic is
right,
illegal.
Right, but is it subject to the same laws as hacking? Because those are a different set of criminal law.
I would think not. I mean, you're not doing anything with software. If you're not the one doing anything with software, you're not hacking.
Well,
software.
And that's the question, because there are a lot of folks who would make that leap, especially, you know, if they're not software engineers, or maybe some software engineers would be, and say, like, what, you're making a manipulation to input to a software package.
You're not even using a computer, you're just walking around the real world. I think it'd be easier to, you know, if you put up a stop sign on the side of a road, especially on a freeway, and all of a sudden all the self-driving cars just stopped right there in the freeway, that would be an intentional, dangerous thing to do to traffic, just like rolling a beach ball into the traffic, right? It's not, mm-hmm. the beach ball itself is not going to hurt anything, but someone's going to swerve and hit something and it's going to be really bad. So that activity that's kind of like vandalism or disturbing the peace, that kind of role is a perfectly valid way to attack someone. You're saying, well, they could also call it hacking and therefore throw a whole bunch of other laws of the books at them. Now, I think if you did that, I'm not going to have a lot of pity for you.
Right. Now, at the same time, when I was talking about, well, they would have maps of the roads and they would know what was going on, there's a lot of stuff that goes on that's not on the maps.
Mm.
Road construction.
Sure. The cars have to.
You're driving along Highway 9 and half the road falls away. And so now they have a one-lane road with a light.
The area that Miles and I live in, the roads fall apart regularly.
The roads wash out from underneath the thin layer of asphalt.
Well, okay, so the question of, are you hacking, if you take advantage of the stupidity of these smart cars, are you hacking? I think it really would depend on what you do. Have you ever seen those images that fool face detection software,
yeah.
right? That is not a face at all. We don't look at it as a face, but software is like, yep, that's a face. In fact, that's Frank. And you're like, well, that's just a whole bunch of triangles on a page. What are you talking about? It doesn't even look, it doesn't have eyes. So that same kind of thing can also happen with self-driving cars. It's just that they happen to be these really fast robots that can kill people accidentally. So it is a little bit more of a concern. I would assume there'll be laws in place specifically for messing with self-driving cars as they become more popular. We'll get more bad laws. Don't worry about it.
Now the rubber is hitting the road of, this is no longer the intellectual exercise we had a few years back,
sure.
talking about
the trolley problem.
Yeah. Will people accept them? We're seeing how much it's being accepted versus not. I mean, when people are accepting when they shouldn't be, Uber in Arizona, and when it's a bit more vague.
Did you you're familiar with the term the trolley trolley problem, right? With
regards to self-driving cars, whether or not
you've got four people on a railroad track and one person on a railroad track, and you control the switch, and you can decide to switch it. If you don't do anything, it's going to kill the four people. You can switch it and kill the one person. So your inactivity would cause the death of four people. Your activity will cause the death of one person, but saving the lives of four people.
Right.
And that question of like, what would you do, is an interesting problem with psychology, just ethical problem in general we should think about, and self-driving cars have to implement that in software, and that's an interesting social problem of deciding that choice.
Except the leaders of self-driving cars have come out saying it doesn't really apply. Most of the reason why we end up in those situations, like what we described with the trolley problem, is because of our inattention blindness. We don't see until it's too late to have to make that decision, right. And the vehicles don't have inattention,
right,
and so they're constantly scanning the area and
to make
they
the best
see
move every time, yeah,
right. So that need to make that split second decision becomes vastly diminished.
Right. We've talked about the trolley problem; it's a big thing when we talk about AI cars and all that. Mm-hmm. But what I thought was really interesting is someone actually did not a thorough test, but an actual video about doing. Like they did a presentation of like 12 people. They brought them into a room. They set up the trolley process and filmed it and talked about it with the people. And it's really intense to watch someone decide what to do. And they do, like in this video, you get to see somebody deciding to switch that switch and another person not deciding to switch the switch. And that whole engagement, I'll find the video and link it to today's page. It's definitely a watch because it's interesting to see how people put in that. It's also really intense, of course, to be put in a position where you think you're going to have to decide to kill somebody. Okay, let's move on to Facebook.
Okay.
To be a little lighter on things. No, not really lighter. Facebook's pretty serious at this point. We'll get into a lot of the details about it, but what I found fascinating through this whole process of Facebook, kind of some bad press coming out about them, some pretty nasty information, which we're going to get into in a second. During that, people started spreading this idea of delete Facebook, hashtag delete Facebook. Of course, they're doing that on Twitter. And
some people are doing it on Facebook, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure they were. And Elon Musk, of course, the president of, or sorry, CEO of Tesla and also of SpaceX, kind of flippantly responded to that post with, what's Facebook, as a joke. And the person doing, you know, people were like, well, if you really think of that serious, then delete the pages, and pointed to SpaceX or something. He's like, yeah, that's a good idea. And then they said, and what about for Tesla? And he's like, yeah, it doesn't look very good anyway. And within, you know, a few hours, those two high profile, 20,000 more people following them, Facebook pages were deleted from Facebook. And the first thing I thought is, man, Elon, did you do that with thought and intention and talk to PR? Did you do it shooting off the hip? Was it just like, yeah, it makes sense to delete it? Or was it a really concerned thought process that people talked about? And I don't know the answer to that. Part of me is like, I want to hear that he just does things on whims, like sending a car into orbit. Makes sense, right? Sending a car to Mars. But the other part of me is like, well, that's also an extremely smart thing to do at that time period. It doesn't affect his business, really. In fact, he probably got a lot of press and a lot of people give more love to Tesla and SpaceX because of it, right? So what do you think of it? Do you think it was a calculated thing, or do you think it was just like, yeah, it makes sense, delete it?
I don't think that the Tesla Facebook page makes a big deal to their bottom line.
Sure doesn't. No.
I mean, they've got people on their waiting list. It's not really a
no. It won't
issue.
Affect them. And in fact, he actually later on kind of responded in more depth in this Twitter feed and in other ways, I think, as well, talking about how they don't do endorsements by celebrities. They don't really, that social aspect is not their marketing arm.
Celebrities other than their CEO.
Yeah. Yeah.
the anyway, cult of personality there.
It's kind of a fun Twitter feed to read. You can get to it from geekspeak.org. For today's show. All right, so get to some more serious stuff. It seems like a scramble of how these were ordered. Do you order these in specific
morning? No, I didn't.
Okay, then let's roll back to what Cambridge Analytica was able to do with Facebook's API in the early days.
In other words, scraping the social graph off the system. So they're able to get a fair amount of data from Facebook, pretending to be academic researchers when they were in fact political operatives.
Did they have special permissions outside of what any app developer at the time had?
Yes, like I said, it was on par with what you would have for
a research.
Yeah, an actual academic research.
So early days of Facebook, you know, that was the .com era, and every online service was giving an API to their services.
No, Facebook was after .com. Web 2.0. Yeah.
Web 2.0 was what I meant. Sorry. So, you know, we had Flickr as the canonical example of being able to use an interface and access data and put it in your own web app.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, you know, as you started playing with Ruby on Rails, for example, one of the examples was to pull images from Flickr. Another example was from the Twitter feed. And also, I think maybe it wasn't examples of Facebook. It might have come out a little bit later. But relatively quickly, Facebook, you know, kind of wanted to be a platform. And to do that, what you do is you produce an online platform. You let other developers come along. The more developers you get investing in your area, the richer your area gets. And the more users find value in the service. That was the general idea at the time in the Web 2.0 era. And so Facebook created a pretty substantial API to do just that. So I created an app early on, and I tried finding the app. It was a PHP library that basically I installed on my own server and then registered as the app on Facebook. And once I approved that app, the app that I had made, if you will, once I approved it as a Facebook user and said, yes, you can do this, it would then, every time I ran a script, it would go and get the most recent posts that I had made, the content I had made from Facebook, images, videos, whatever, mm-hmm. and download and copy them over to my server and put them in my own database. The whole point I did that for was that I don't like the idea of content that I create online being trapped in the service that I created in.
Yeah, the walled garden.
The walled garden. So I, early on, just registered that and was running that. I had to stop running it because it was too much data as it got bigger. Because even the access that I got, even though I was the only user that even could use this app, any place that I commented, if I could read the feed, that content, and I made a comment or a like, the entire feed was copied to my database because the API had access to it. So you're a friend of mine. You post a picture of your dog, maybe this dog right here, Bonsai, who's sleeping. And I go, oh, Bonsai's so cute. And when I do that, because I participated in that feed, the system that I was using, I had access to you, and I mm-hmm. gave it full access, so everything about you could be copied. The other things that you allowed me to see was your entire friends list, because we're friends. In fact, for a while, there was a kind of defaulty experience of share with friends of friends. It was one of the choices on how mm-hmm. to share things. So relatively quickly—
Well, you still have that. You still have share with friends or share with—it's friends and acquaintances.
Right. Yeah. So— even without having special access, I was building data, and I should look at the database. I'm sure I have a copy of it somewhere. I was building large masses of data around my direct cloud, if you will, which was two separations away from me. Because commonly, your friends that I have, you know, have access through you, mm-hmm. I could see their social graph or at least part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was without even trying to make some kind of app that would be compelling. So nothing I've heard from except for the reports that say they had special access, shows me that they actually needed special access. So,
the data that Facebook gives in large aggregate is typically anonymized. But then once you start crawling like you had, you can take that data that they have collated together to find trends and then map that to individuals.
Right.
By looking for specific keys. And that's what Cambridge Analytica was doing and other actors as well are doing.
This cross-referencing, this second channel data sources is what you're talking about. You know, they had some mass anonymized data and they also had this crawling data, and together that produced a more detailed picture of everybody. We had an example of that in the Netflix infrastructure history. And I'll go ahead and talk about it. Ooh, exciting, huh? Inside secrets. And it's a very simple thing. We wanted, a long time ago, before I was at Netflix, there was a contest to participate in a better algorithm to detect what people would want to watch on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a $1 million prize. And so a whole bunch of research teams came along, and the payload that they got from Netflix was an anonymized play data of users, and mm-hmm. basically all the information about the user and even the times they watched things were completely anonymized. So all you had was user one watched all these shows, and started these shows but didn't finish them. That kind of data. And a mass amount of data. Everybody got the same data set. And then they'd run a model trying to predict good stuff. And when they submitted that model to us, we ran it off data we didn't give them to see if it was accurate. Right? That was the general process. Mm-hmm. Somebody did win. We paid $1 million. It was kind of cool.
And then you didn't end up using the algorithm.
Then supposedly that we didn't end up using the algorithm. We learned a lot from it and have, of course, done a lot of research since then. And there's a lot of papers and public knowledge about how our systems work. And we won't go into it right now, but it's kind of cool stuff. It's not my expertise. So in any case, one of the things that somebody did was they took this anonymized data and they just cross-referenced to IMDb. And in IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes, maybe it was both of them, you can rank stuff that you like. Any person can go and say, I like this movie, I didn't like this movie, I didn't like this movie, I like this movie. And what basically you're able to do is get high viability of who in the Netflix data set was that user on Rotten Tomatoes or on IMDb or both sets. So it's basically just because both those data sets were available and you could mesh them pretty easily to say, oh, look, 95% of the things that are rated by this user, this other user on Netflix, you know, that's the same user. And so it was able to kind of connect mm-hmm. it. And it's a perfect example of Netflix actually didn't give any personalized data. But because there's other knowledge out in the universe, with that anonymized data, more data was being able to glean by right. personal accounts. We don't do that anymore. That was obviously, you know, not something you want to do. But it's kind of interesting that we have that very simple, you know, simple to understand problem. And you can see how easily it would occur in any situation where you try to anonymize data.
Right. There's also a difference. I read an interesting article. It was talking about the difference between the ad models of Google and Facebook. And the fact that both can be considered predatory in some ways. Mm-hmm. Kind of creepy is what I mean. Are you interested in this? The Amazon style. But it talked about a very fundamental difference between the two, which was Google, you basically, you know, selling to advertisers. Advertisers would say like, hey, we have this, you know, mousetrap.
Yeah.
Better mousetrap. And so I want to have my ad shown to people that are looking for mousetraps. Mm-hmm. And then Google collects data like looking at search data and email and throwing through all of that to find here's a subset of people that are more interested in mousetraps, you know, that are yeah. in the exterminator business or whatever.
Sure. Show an interest in rodents.
Right. a murderous attitude toward rodents, but yes. And
not all mousetraps are deadly.
Right. And then when someone through the AdSense sharing programs from various websites, not just Google products, when people went there, it went, oh, this is a person that fits that profile, so I'm going to put that ad there. And we'll tell the advertiser, hey, we got this many ad impressions. This is people that are correlated. But the person who was posting the ad had no direct knowledge about who was getting it other than just raw numbers and, you know, correlative right. factors.
Meaning the ad was actually serviced by Facebook itself, so there was no login information.
Google, yeah.
I'm sorry, Google. So there's no log information going back to the advertiser.
Right. Facebook was a different model. Facebook, you were putting ads on there where you're saying, I want a certain affinity, but you had access to that social graph to do that correlation that you were talking about before that allows you to really start cross-referencing with actual people and then start being able to...
Meaning, I want mousetrap people that live in Scotts Valley, California.
Right.
And all of a sudden, there's only, you know, 300 people or 20 people. And so you get closer and closer with that data. Or are you saying that the ads were served by the advertiser and the affiliate or advertiser, mm-hmm. And therefore the actual traffic hit their site so they could tell what kind of browser and all that? Well, which one is that?
No, it's they got the ad information just like before, but because they had access to the social graph of Facebook and you have these troves, gotcha. You're able to cross-reference.
Okay.
And start
so
finding out more specific information.
So they're expanding their social graph and collecting it. From this crawling from apps perspective.
Right.
And then they use advertising at the same time. And that's what Cambridge Analytica was doing.
Right. Now, mousetraps, you go like, eh, it's mousetraps. Like maybe someone gets a bit more direct advertisement, you know, through correlative effects or whatnot. But it becomes a lot more dangerous when you factor in things like the housing issue that Facebook had where you're able to collate you know, affinity with African-American community, affinity with
Hispanic. We
covered
the story a couple of times. Basically, you could say, you could advertise for only white people seeing an ad for housing, which is actually legal, federally illegal.
Right. Well, actually, you couldn't do it for white people because white people were considered a default. There was no white people
right.
setting
in there.
Right.
You could say affinity towards black culture or something.
You could exclude affinity towards African-American culture, affinity towards exclusion for Latin American
yeah.
culture.
Obviously, not not something that Facebook should be allowed in their system. So, you know, one of the things you're touching upon...
the whole thing I was talking about before, where instead of a mousetrap, now consider it who's going to be a good person to recruit for Nazis, you know, for a shock troop.
Or who is more likely to enter a contest for a free iPhone and give more information. Lots of things that are kind of pseudo-nefarious can be targeted at exactly the people that might be viable to target.
Right. Or for that matter, who are the people that are more likely to submit information in a careless fashion, try to collate who those people are, and then target them for confidence games.
Right.
That's the weaponizing of the social graph is really the story of the day. And people have been kind of fixating on the political aspect of it, like, oh, Russia, you know, tampering and ads and who's going to vote for Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. And I very much believe that's the tip of the iceberg. That's
sure.
the fact that you can, and I think that it's an appropriate word, weaponize whatever political philosophy or, you know, scam or whatnot out there with once you have a certain level of technical knowledge,
mm-hmm.
it becomes a very dangerous thing. A way I heard it described on the radio, as a matter of fact, was tech companies dealing with the fact that in many ways are kind of unraveling the fabric of society.
Yeah.
When very much 10 years ago, it was like, no, we're going to fix everything. Was this mantra of tech. Like, we're going to throw AI at these problems, and the problems are going to be solved.
So one of the things that I pride myself in finding vulnerabilities in systems. I'm always thinking that way. We're geeks, right? So one of the things we think about is how a system works and how a system can be faulty. And so, you know, when I go through security at an airport, I'm like, wow, they're not thinking about this, or they are thinking about this, or they're overreacting to this, even though it could be, you know, the rules are set up in such a way to be more representational of theater than actual security. And you can see examples of that as you're there and thinking about it. But my mind did not go that way in Facebook. When I saw that I had access to all this data and could pull all this data down from Facebook, I didn't think of it nefariously. And I was really shocked by that recently when I was like, yeah, I knew that you could get all this data early on. And that app was existing for a long time. I just shut it off or deleted it at some point because I didn't have it set up anymore. But obviously, if you didn't, you could keep doing that. And it's pretty nefarious. Why did I not think that way in the beginning? And the reason I didn't think that way in the beginning is, who cared? No one cared what Facebook was in 2004, 2005. It was just where people were sharing little stories. There was nothing.
It's where the college kids went to socialize.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was invited by a college kid because I was at a college, you know, mm-hmm. and that's how I got my first account. I could actually get an account because I had
an EDU. Yeah,
an EDU domain. That's what Facebook first opened up to. So it wasn't that I didn't see the power of what you could do with this API. It was that there was just nothing interesting there. I mean, I could also crawl all of Flickr and download all their images too, but then I'd have a whole bunch of images. Like, what would it matter? And so over time, that growth, of course, mattered more and more. And now, of course, most of news data comes through Facebook. Most event planning, it happens through Facebook. Like, it's pretty powerful.
There's another thing, and this is one that I've avoided for a while because I did see the problem with it. Where friends were constantly posting, hey, this is your top 10, like, answer these, you know, 50 questions and then, you know, copy paste and send it on to your friends. And I'm looking at these questions going, these are by and large the secret questions that banks ask for how do you unlock your account?
Yeah.
What's your pet's name? What's your first pet's name? What's your, you know.
And a lot of people by default post publicly.
Yeah. And at the same time, like when you're doing it by friends, that social graph, and you make friends with a friend of yours, suddenly they have access to the post that you make.
The thing is, I never find those things compelling. I don't think I've ever answered one. I should look through my history, but I don't think I've ever answered one.
It wasn't so much about not being compelling, although there have been ones where they seem fun. It's just like social camaraderie. That's what Facebook is banking on, is the fact that people get on there for social camaraderie. Now, the thing about it, though, was seeing this and going, wait, you folks, don't do this.
Right.
And there is something about wanting to socialize and the very well-cultivated feeling for people just going onto Facebook that they are barraged with messages from people they know.
Yeah.
That you
so it feels
your guard
like a safe space.
Yeah, your guard is down for, wait, but no, I'm posting this to this
planet.
Third party. Yeah.
Yeah. So a really interesting article I want to talk about from Bloomberg. It's actually written by Zake Fox, F-A-U-X. I'm assuming it's pronounced Fox. He writes about a conference in June of 2017. So this is not a time where being scrupulous of Facebook is rare.
Scrutinous. Yeah.
Scrutinous?
Yeah.
Scrutinous. Thank you.
Scrupulous.
You pedant. Yeah. It was in Berlin. And I'll read a bit to give you a little context of who the people are that are at this conference. They're affiliates. So this is a quote from the article. All the most popular hustlers were there. Miracle diet pills, instant muscle builders, brain boosters, male enhancers. The You Want an iPhone companies had display booths, and the Your Computer May Be Infected folks sent salesmen. Russia was represented by the promoters of the Black Mask face peel, and Canada made a showing with bot-infested eating sites. Or, excuse me, bot-infested dating sites. So these are people that are affiliates, right? So the general flow of what of advertisers on social media, advertisers in general, are not the companies that are actually have the product, unless they're a giant company like a car company or something, mm-hmm. or a Netflix or, you know, larger companies. They do it themselves. But most companies that, like, I have some diet pills that I think I want to sell for $9 a month, the subscription. And so they will say, well, it's $9 a month. Subscription, so I will give a recruiting fee to a subscriber of $10. So if you can sign somebody up, I'll give you $10. So you as the affiliate would be just someone like, oh, $10 commission on somebody signing up for that seems pretty fair. So you will actually, out of your own pocket, buy a whole bunch of ad space and target these pills. You'll get pictures and stuff from the person that made the pills or the salespeople, and then you will direct traffic over with a link that represents who you are. So every commission that you make commissions off of every person that goes and buys the service. And that is why you have this kind of industry behind this, right? Because you as an affiliate might be great at selling pills one month, and then the next month you might be focusing on free iPhones. And in general, you might be giving away free iPhones to get people to buy the pills, mm-hmm. because a free iPhone at a certain rate is actually cost effective for you. So there's all these strategies to get people sucked in, and they're done by these middle people that can break laws and get arrested, but doesn't actually affect the general flow of cash, because every company that's selling those diet pills has 50 affiliates actually doing things for them. And some of them are nefarious and some of them are okay. And it's not really the pill selling company that's the one that's doing the bad, except the infrastructure is set up that way. So that's what this conference was. And it's hosted by an online forum called Stack That Money, which is a place where people talk about...
Yeah, that sounds legit.
Yes, it's being affiliates. And that... You know, that existing in itself makes sense. There's a whole industry about it. There's people making millions of dollars off this, so it makes sense to have a conference. You then charge. So now you're you know, pulling in $2,000 or $3,000 per attendee, and they get all this knowledge. But the thing that's interesting about this is that who's on the stage actually hosting the event and introducing people and introducing speakers and moderating panel discussion? Facebook employees. And so Facebook's there. Now, the outward presentation is not we're a miracle pill company. The outward presentation is we're affiliate advertisers and we do business legally. And there are bad people, but they're not in this room. But when this reporter scratched the surface, that's just the veneer. The truth is these people are the people that are doing the giveaways and scamming as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And Facebook's kind of there as well. And of course they are, because that's their customer. You know, we always talk about we're a product on Facebook, on these social systems, we're a product, and that the advertisers are the customer. Well, the advertisers are not the Lexus and all these high end. The advertisers, most of the money is coming from these small affiliates, and they are just mom and pop people pulling in $500,000 a year scamming people. So that's Facebook's customer base. And that reading this article and kind of describing it made me feel very different about Facebook. Because my general take is it from a technology perspective, the API they created, Zuckerberg's story, you know, the people I know that work at Facebook who some of them I love and are doing really awesome work, and the open source packages that Facebook produces, which, you know, React is a really cool web package I've gotten really excited about, and they produce it and help make it happen and run really cool conferences. So most of my interactions at Silicon Valley buddy-buddy space, but in reality, they're paying a lot of money to affiliates, or affiliates are making a lot of money from them. Mm-hmm. Getting a lot of money for the ads that the affiliates pay them for. Yeah.
And personally, something that just drives me up the wall from knowing what I know about security with regard to the social graph is when I see something posted on a friend's wall of, this person got so-and-so points on this quiz, yeah, or, you know, got this score in this game. Because when I look at that, my immediate thought is that person clicked on a link, they got taken to some other page, they did the quiz or played the game, whatever, and then there was the box that says, click this button
to see
your score. Maybe if they're more honest, they'll say, click this to share your score on Facebook, you know, but most of the time they're like, you can't see the result of the last 15 minutes you've spent doing this and unless you press this button.
And they set it all up so that you will spend time answering these questions that are kind of interesting and engaging. So the person's kind of invested their time, mm-hmm, and therefore they feel like it's viable to answer that.
And as soon as that person clicks that button, I realize, well, there goes my information. Because I am friends with them. Yeah. So as soon as they click that button, they've now made an acceptance to have that affiliate look at their page and then by extension their friend's page with anything that has something that friend can see.
Right.
Which is basically all the posts, because that's what you post there is the stuff that your friends can see. And it just drives me up the wall and being told over and over again by friends, like, it's not that big of a deal. It's just a quiz. It's just a game. It's like, no, that's exactly how
it's interesting.
Cambridge Analytica and others were able to cross-reference that data. That's right. Exactly what the tactics they used.
Well, that's the thing that's so interesting is that, of course, you know what they get access to when they approve a Facebook app. I'm really curious how many people have if you go into Facebook settings, if you still have your account and you go into Facebook settings, you can actually go find what apps have permission. You should go look at that page because you probably have a lot more permissions than you think you have because of this kind of thing. You know, one day in March, one morning, you said yes to one of those things. It still has access to your graph. Like you gave it permission. It's still looking at you. You really want to go in there and just prune everything out that you don't need in there. Okay. So that's a bit about Facebook. Now, there was some response from Mark Zuckerberg.
Yes, and it's actually a very interesting thing. Since 2008 was one of the first times that Zuckerberg came out talking about Facebook and privacy. And it's now been 10 years, literally 10 years, of Mark Zuckerberg saying almost exactly the same thing about we value your privacy and we're working hard to make sure that things like X don't happen. You know, the privacy violation of the day, the data leak of the day. And it's been the same thing for 10 years, the same speech over and over again with slightly different...
Did you see a compilation of this? Somebody put together a compilation of him saying
I didn't actually.
I haven't seen that either. It just sounds like it's something you could do. So
most of the stuff's been written.
But don't you believe
that? Yeah.
Let me say it this way. Don't you believe that he believes that? I don't think he's nefarious.
I don't believe that he is honestly trying to be malicious with regard to this.
I agree.
Don't believe that he tried to manipulate Facebook to have Facebook increased the amount of violence in Rohingya, which was an area that was Facebook was used as a conduit for people to cyberbully and commit hate crimes.
What do you mean a conduit?
one of the aspects of, for example, Twitter back in the day was that was being put forth as the reason behind the Arab Spring as a way to communicate or stuff. Well, the same thing was happening with regard to Myanmar, where Facebook was being used as a way to coordinate hate groups to focus and find vulnerable people.
I see. So that people are using Facebook as a mechanism to find people.
Right. And also amplify an anti-Muslim and anti-Rohingya
And of course,
sentiment.
Facebook has that Silicon Valley kind of effect of free speech is important and paramount. And so there's not as much policing as they could, or is just
I would
the
like
volume
to say more along
high.
The lines of the I don't intend to do wrong, so therefore I'm not subject to the consequences of my actions.
Okay.
I've become much more cynical with regard to that. And especially because right now they're under a lot more scrutiny. They have Zuckerberg's going to have to go before Congress to discuss this.
Go ahead. Do you have any other stories about Facebook? Because I want to talk about kind of – I want to wrap that up a bit. Is there another story?
Yeah, which was just before the latest
– apology.
Well, latest dust up with regard to Cambridge Analytica and the 2016 election and mm-hmm. stuff that's come out since then. Facebook was actually in talks for a data sharing agreement with hospitals with regard to all of our health data.
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that fell through.
It has been shelved.
Okay, but keep
at the same
in mind,
time,
I've heard arguments for opening our health data up.
Yes.
And they're really strong. We could – like right now, if you took one good actor and gave them all the health information mm-hmm. of the United States, you would save thousands of people every day. Like it's mm-hmm. – it would be an immense amount of growth and knowledge about disease
Absolutely.
And fighting and prescription problems. And Google's been pushing for this for a long time too because mm-hmm. they know that if they crunch that data, they'll go, oh my gosh, this is a problem. Let's fix this.
Yeah,
and
Google, Microsoft have both tried to go into this area.
It's just a very challenging place to go because of people's concerns about privacy around it.
Right.
And it totally makes sense for Facebook to do the same type of thing. Like they can already detect depression, right? They know when people are depressed because they can read their posts. And they already have we talked about a few shows ago, they already have a methodology in place to actually get a counselor for someone if they see that – if an algorithm sees that a person seems to be going down a dark space, they'll have a human review it and the human can actually ask someone to intervene for that person. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to do good.
But just because you are trying to do good and even if you do manage to do some good, there is a fundamental lack of recognition of how your product can be weaponized for really horrible ends.
Yeah. So how do we – so this is the meat that I want to get into with you. We want some of the benefits that Facebook has. We definitely want at some point to gain more information about health and make better medical decisions for everybody, right? Which is one of the mm-hmm. goals that Facebook clearly was trying to do. How do we move to a space where this kind of power can benefit society and not have these kind of problems? Where do we do? Do we start doing a whole bunch of legislation around corporations?
Yeah,
like
honestly,
Facebook?
I believe regulation does have a strong aspect to it, that you set rules that are not simply based upon a profit motive, mm-hmm. that you say, this is the data we want to get. Here are some guidelines that you cannot cross.
How do you do that intelligent? How do you write laws around these problems? These problems are so complex. Like the idea of a social graph and whose data is that is a problem in itself.
Mm-hmm.
None of your social connectedness are solely owned by you. By definition, they're owned by someone else at least. But the graph is almost like an emergent quality
right.
that is part of the network.
There's a mixture there because one, right now with the way that our healthcare system is set up, there is a severe liability having your medical knowledge go out to anyone.
Because healthcare won't take you on as a patient.
Right. Insurance is a nightmare, limited access. There's employer stigma that can go along with it. So when you have a country like the United States that doesn't have a universal health coverage system, that ends up being a huge barrier there that your medical history or some fact that you uncover from it in a universal healthcare system doesn't have the same effect, doesn't have the same negatives. With regard to other aspects that we consider extremely private, how much money we make, how much we pay in taxes. I mean, we have the president that says, I'm not going to release my taxes, and there's no legal reason why that must be so. At the same time, that's not how it has to be.
Right.
It's just how we've gotten used to it. In Sweden, you can see anyone's income or taxes. It's all public. And it actually had a great effect in terms of figuring out where income inequality lies, like seeing trends, say, you know, women were paid less than men in certain scenarios, or, you know, black versus white versus Asian, things like that. And so making all that data public to begin with and, you know, shining a light, that's one thing. But in what we have right now is this really weird setup where we want to keep all of those systems secret, but we want to have data that exposes all of that information and disseminates it in such a way that it respects the secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I think the complexity comes from. It's that we're working on at cross purposes for it. We're not making a decision about this is how we want to be.
Right.
In which case you say, all right, no medical research, and we want everything to be that that pay for system. That's what we've decided on. And so the idea of we're going to have this open medical data to get information, that is the antithesis of the system we've set up for healthcare. They're at cross purposes. They
right.
don't work.
Right.
But if you set up a system where you say, all right, you're going to have open data and you're going to data mine and do these things, and it's going to have this effect on here, we need to have society's laws change on the social end, on the general public end, irrespective of the data, or you restrict the data.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just needs to have a common policy to decide which way you're going to go.
The general idea of, like, let's say switching to a place where everybody's salary is public and all taxes mm-hmm. are public, that would, I would say you'd get like a 90% hate aspect of that from Americans. I don't think our culture would like that idea. Do you disagree?
I don't know about 90%. But yes, it would be a very hard sell. There would be essentially no veneer over exactly how far income equality goes. And people like their comfortable veneers.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's one of the society lies that we propagate, right? Where we hide that information.
Right. There's also the aspect of, and harkening back to healthcare, it's like right now, if you made universal healthcare, yes, a lot of people are going to flood the healthcare system because there's a whole lot of folks that have been sick that haven't gone to use the healthcare system or that needed it. The same thing would be true of income. We've spent so much time not letting you know how much, you know, the person you work with makes. You have companies constantly saying, don't tell, you know, people how much you make. You know, it's
yeah.
And the longer you go with that and the longer that perpetuates, the harder it is to actually tell the truth, because once you do, it's dramatically destabilizing that you have one person that's making so much more than the five other people that are doing the same job, or, you know, the one person that's making, or, you know, the three people that are making so much less than the 10 other people that are in the job, especially if you start seeing the correlations of this has to do with sexual orientation, or this has to do with skin color or religion, things like that. And that's the part that I think people are most resistant to. That first step is a doozy. Absolutely will be.
Mm-hmm.
Companies will absolutely fold over this because it's a major monetary liability. Yeah, is it worth it? I don't know.
All these corporations have this giant secret about their salary situations with staff,
and
it's just an accepted thing. There are some companies that have transparency around it, but most don't. Of course, execs have transparency around them,
but for public companies.
Yeah,
for public companies only. And so that doesn't apply to like many hedge fund managers and stuff like that. But yeah,
I guess what I was trying to work at is, does it make sense to have this kind of power of a social network owned by a corporation with legislation, or does it make sense to try to produce a nonprofit or a governmental agency that actually produces and provides a social graph? And if it's not a corporation, how is it paid for? People don't actually want to pay for these things. Like all these networks that start up with like Twitter, but you have to pay $9 a month. So we will never advertise. Well, it didn't take off. No, people don't want to spend that much.
Right.
So normally people are actually okay with a slight trade that they make with having advertising and having some tracking going on to get free pictures of the cats.
Right. People's expectations of some advertising, some tracking doesn't necessarily match up with the reality of how deep it goes in many cases.
So, and also, this is not just social networks. This is happening everywhere. I mean,
yes.
The reason
everything is a social network now. Yeah. That was the big push from 5-7 years ago, right? Everyone was going, let's get on the social. Let's get on the social.
And you know, the club card that you go to the grocery store with, the card at the grocery store, and then you ask to get the number so they give you a discount. The reason they do that is so they can track you and they can advertise to you. Like, that's what that's about. It's the same thing as saying yes to the license agreement with Facebook. You're doing that by joining that membership thing at the grocery store. And every place has this kind of thing. And it's very hard to get away from that. I mean, as you start using your credit card places, one of the reasons why Apple's wallet was a very clever way of dealing with is that every merchant you use your thing with is an unique iCredit card number, so mm-hmm. that they can't track you cross merchants, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, if you're using a credit card or an ATM card places and you keep going to that store, even if you don't have a membership with them, they will track you as well. Mm-hmm. It's just inherently part of their software system. It's not a bad decision for them to make as a business.
Which will actually go a little bit further once you get more into face tracking. So even a company where you don't have a club card, like the Amazon model where they were working for the store that you can just walk in, grab something off the shelf and walk out and there's no checkout line. I mean, that is, you have to have an Amazon account and set that up. But what happens if you're paying by cash, but there is still facial recognition? They can track, you know, when a particular person, even if they don't know the name, until someone swipes their credit card and suddenly you do have a name that goes along with
right.
it.
It's really hard, as we know, to stay outside that system. And the thing is, we're getting benefit from it, right? The corporations makes a little bit more money being able mm-hmm. to advertise and buy the right amount of food because they know the customer base better. Therefore, they take, you know, you get some of that benefit in the sense that they lower their rates a bit because of it.
And there is arguably benefit for IC ads that are not just general scattershot, but the ones that seem to be most interesting to me, although those do end up reinforcing an echo chamber, not introducing you to new experiences. But that's still, I can see that point of, I really need this thing. It detects that you need that thing. And then the advertisers that sell that thing are able to say, hey, I have that thing. You want to go get it. In theory, that's a very good thing.
We have this great example of this in our house that Maggie always responds to, my partner Maggie. She did costumes for Rocky Horror Picture Show. So she did all these bodices and clothes for Rocky Horror Picture Show. After she did that, for a long time, she was just presented with male. What's the bodice? Bodice? Bodice is large enough for a man. Is that a bodice? That's under the thing that goes around your torso that lifts up cleavage if you have it and you tie it in back?
Sure, yeah.
No, it's not called a bodice. It's called something else.
I mean,
that thing. Anyway.
The thing that goes around your midsection, that's a girdle. And then you have,
thank you.
Well, that's just a slimming agent.
That kind of gear for not her body type, right? Like, it doesn't really work for her. She's not going to buy it anymore. She still gets things like that because at some point the tracking system was like, she's into this kind of clothing. And so we'll just keep on advertising
right,
to her.
Or this actually brings up a fun anecdote from Twitter where someone was complaining. Yeah.
Corset. Corset. That was the word I was looking for.
Oh, okay, yeah. When you need – when she bought a toilet seat, she needed that toilet seat at that moment. Like, she needed that. But she doesn't need advertisements. Oh, so if you like that toilet seat, what about these toilet seats? I only got that toilet
seat
because I needed it at that moment. I don't need them in general. And at the same time, I could totally see how she's an outlier from the AI because most people who buy toilet seats are going to be people that work in plumbing.
Right.
Buy a whole lot of toilet seats.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or like a hotel company or something. Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, we see that kind of problem in the software and understand it from an engineering perspective. Like, well, how do you make a good algorithm? Like, also, the same algorithm that's deciding to advertise toilet seats – also just looks at her in general and sees the things she buys, right? So she might buy detergent, she might buy a bodice, she might buy a toilet seat. And giving her more ads for detergent makes sense because every month she's going to buy more of it, right? But some of those things you're not going to buy but once.
Right. And then you have the aspect of AI does not have any sense of empathy or context or sensitivity. Yeah. So when a person buys an urn for a recently passed loved one, and then they periodically have ads saying, well, you like that urn. What about this one and this one? Do you want to buy that urn again?
Like, oh, God. See the same urn that's like painful?
Which actually happened to someone,
course.
Right?
I mean, the examples of this go long, go deep. You know,
do you want this coffin? How about this used coffin? I'm not making that up. Yeah. Think about that for a moment.
I think it's
used
called
coffin. Creedless.
I think it's previously used coffin. It's bad. You know, when you simplify down what the systems are trying to do to a human scale, the creep factor goes away. For example, if you had a shop that you go to every day, and at lunchtime you seem to buy the same thing, when you come in the door and they say, hey, you want the regular? And you say, yes, please. That feels good, right? There's a human there. They know who you are. There's a social connection. They're going to make the sandwich the way you want it with a little bit of mayonnaise that you like and not a lot. You know, the whole process is better because they know you.
But less efficient. And there's that whole...
No, I would say...
Once you include human beings, you're adding inefficiency. And there's that question of, is the more efficient automatically better? And we're finding in a lot of ways that it's not automatically better.
To be clear, though, that sandwich experience of buying was better. And if that can be done in the online space, that will be better in the sense that, yeah, I do want that detergent again. It's been about a month. I do want it again. Thank you for knowing that. Click a button. It is useful to me. So there is a bit of that going on that is a benefit.
Now remember, there's also another aspect to that, which is you go into the sandwich shop and that person remembers you and starts making your sandwich ahead of time and has it ready to go. You are also able to recognize there is a human being there who took the time to remember me specifically.
That's right.
An AI that where your sandwich just kind of appears.
Yeah.
Does not have the same emotional stimulus to you.
I did a talk recently at UCSC, another thing I've been busy with, and I talked about personalization and what it used to mean and what it now means, right? At one point, personalization means that a person did something for you. The case we have now is haircuts. When you go and get a haircut from somebody, they have to do something for you. A human being's doing that for you. It turned into, like, personalization turned into, like, monograms, so you could get your luggage monogrammed so it's personally made by you. Of course, it was made in mass and then something was stuck on. But that thing with your initials on it, that is made for you. There was a human being involved in that. And then, of course, we have the canonical solution in software. What I used to teach at UCSC all the time was mail merge. You take a spreadsheet of email of names and addresses, and you take one document that you write that says, hey, thanks so much, fill in first name, and you produce a personalized letter from that system. There's no human involved in the whole process except for the original writer, and that original writer is writing a non-human thing. They're writing specifically not to a person. To an ambiguous idea that a future person may exist. And that system, we now kind of understand there's nothing. When you get a mail address to you, has no meaning to you at all. Who cares, right? Unless it was handwritten. And sometimes it's not even handwritten. It's some robot writing a signature on it. So it looks like it's a handwritten letter. So this dichotomy of us liking personalization and things doing stuff for us because they pay attention to us as a human interaction and the software translation of that. There is a schism in our world that is very real, and I think we still lean on the cheap and easy and efficient rather than the human.
Saying it's quicker, easier, more seductive.
What's that from?
Okay, you just lost your geek card. That's Yoda, Empire Strikes Back. Is the dark side stronger? No, quicker, easier, more seductive. My laptop's about to die.
So. Mine already did die. We are running out of time, sir. It is time to wrap it up. Is there anything else to say?
No, it's a pleasure being back on the podcast with you, man. I missed you.
Oh, really? Oh, good. Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure seeing you.
You're so surprised. You're like, really? You're happy to see me? Wow. Okay.
Miles, I know that you know this, and probably everybody that regularly listens to GeekSpeak knows this, but GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Letterman. It's used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons.
No, stop. You're going to need to do that again because it's not David Letterman.
Oh, that's funny. You know, I'm working. We launched a new David Letterman show at work, and I'm working on that show, and that's why David Letterman came out. What's his name?
It's been a few months. David Lawrence.
You know the hero show, the television show called Heroes. There was a villain called the Puppet Master. That's David Lawrence. Anyway, David Lawrence had a radio show after Geek Speak started, and trademarked or copied service mark the name Geek Speak with regards to radio, and so he lets us use it as long as I mention his radio show. Anyway, he's a voice actor and really cool guy. I like him a lot. We've had shows together before. Anyway, thanks David Lawrence for the use of Geek Speak. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff any way you'd like. You can remix it. You can make money off it. Do anything you want. You just have to say where you get the content. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in his living room is Miles Elam. Miles, thank you so much for being on the show with me.
Always a pleasure.
You can learn more about this show and every episode of GeekSpeak, of course, at geekspeak.org. We're on the social medias. You, again, can find that at geekspeak.org. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And today's title by Greg Merkley up in Canada is...
Self-Driving Robot Fooled by Facebook.
Thank you, Greg Merkley, for the title. And thank you all for listening to GeekSpeak. We'll see you soon.